طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. Every year, the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs in Washington, D.C., holds a conference on the Israeli lobby's ongoing campaign to undermine the Palestinian struggle for liberation from the Israeli occupation of their homeland. This Week in Palestine has covered the event for years and will do so again for this year's conference, which just recently concluded. Over the next few weeks, we will broadcast some of the incredible presentations featured in this year's recent conference. We begin this week with the two opening speakers, Palestinian author and activist Susan Abalawa, followed by scholar and historian Walter Hickson. We begin with the introductions.
So our first speaker today is Susan Abalawa, the acclaimed Palestinian-American poet and writer. She is the author of the international best-selling novel Mornings in Jenin, and her second novel, The Blue Between Sky and Water, was sold in 19 languages before its release. Her latest novel, Against the Loveless World, is a Palestine Book Awards winner. She is also an activist and founded Playgrounds for Palestine, an NGO upholding the right of Palestinian children to play. To raise funds to build more playgrounds, Susan recently launched Aida, a private label olive oil from Palestinian farmers. Today, she will describe why Israel is an apartheid state, as reported by the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, which concluded that Israel is, quote, advancing and cementing the supremacy of one group, Jews, over another, Palestinians. Moreover, Susan has experienced this personally. Her family fled Jerusalem after Israel launched its 1967 war, and she was born in Kuwait 3 years later. She came to this country as a teenager. As she told Amanda Weiss' podcast last December, my exile and the destruction of my family and the destruction of everything, of our whole world, has defined my whole life in so many ways and in very personal ways. Israel has twice denied her entry to her homeland. In 2015, when she attempted to scout new locations for Playgrounds for Palestine, and again in 2018, when she was scheduled to appear at a Palestinian literary festival in Ramallah. Israel has been unable, however, to sever her profound attachment to Palestine. And we couldn't be more pleased to have her join us today. Susan?
Thank you, Janet. And it's nice to be back with the Washington Report and the Institute for Research on Middle East Policy. I'm just going to give a brief overview of apartheid and a top line comparison between South African and Israeli apartheid systems. The word apartheid comes from the Dutch Afrikaans language. It means separateness. It was a white supremacist ideology conceived by the descendants of Dutch colonists in South Africa. Although the concept of apartheid emerged in the early 1930s, it wasn't formalized as a political, social, and legal reality until 1948, ironically, the same year that Israel was created, wherein Zionism, another face of white supremacy, was formalized as a political, social, and legal reality in Palestine. South Africa's Nationalist Party implemented apartheid through such things as a color bar, a hierarchical social stratification system based on race. Israel does not have a color bar, but they do have color-coded license plates, color-coded ID cards that identify one's religion, which has been the basis of their own social, political, and legal stratification of human beings living there. South Africa had something called pass laws, which restricted the movements of indigenous South Africans, generally confining them to restricted Bantustans, unless they had a passbook, which was given to those who served as cheap labor for the ruling white minority. Israel has a far more elaborate mechanism that restricts the movement of people and goods, hundreds of checkpoints making life hell for Palestinian individuals trying to get from one Palestinian town to another Palestinian town, and a near impossibility to enter Jerusalem or the Dakhil, that part of Palestine stolen from us in 1948 by European Zionists. Some Palestinians are given permits, or passbooks, if you will, to enter these 1948 territories as cheap labor. Often, if they overstay overnight their permit allotment, they're imprisoned. The daily commute alone is a horror show of humiliation and abuse for hundreds of thousands of Palestinian laborers. The recent short film by Farah Nabulsi, The Present, which just won the BAFTA award and is nominated for an Oscar, touches briefly on one day laborer's life. In Gaza, where 2 million human beings are locked up in a tiny enclave, Israel prevents students from studying at universities abroad, prevents the sick from seeking medical care outside Gaza, prevents anyone from taking a simple vacation. There are families who have not seen their children, parents, or siblings in decades, even though they're only a few miles away from one another, because Israel has made Gaza a giant prison. Apartheid South Africa instituted anti-miscegenation laws to prevent racial intermarriage. Israel was clever not to explicitly pass such a law, but they, in effect, made it illegal for Jews to marry non-Jews. They accomplished this by requiring all marriages to be performed by religious officials, where rabbinical courts not only strictly forbid interreligious marriage, but also have a bloodline requirement to determine if one is Jewish enough to even marry another Jew by the Orthodox Jewish rabbinical court. A Palestinian with Israeli citizenship who marries a Palestinian from the West Bank or Gaza cannot bring their spouse to live with them. In Jerusalem, Palestinians who do not have citizenship but residency status in Israel likewise cannot live with their spouses in Jerusalem and are frequently forced to choose between keeping their families whole or losing their right to live in their own Jerusalem homes or be near their extended families, the grandparents, aunts, uncles, and cousins. Israel's obsession with religious purity and majority, which is not unlike the Nazi obsession with racial purity, is expressed in a multitude of absurd laws that constantly fret over the so-called demographic threat, their fear of Palestinian babies, and in rules that delve into the minutiae of Jewish bloodlines and so-called Jewish DNA, which refers to a genetically identifiable subset of European society called Ashkenazi Jews, which does not apply to Jews of other regional origins. These are just some of the similarities between apartheid South Africa and apartheid Israel, which are also similar to Nazi Nuremberg and Jim Crow Southern laws. But there are differences. There are big and important differences. The situation in Israel is much worse than it was in South Africa. So said the chairman of the ANC, Baleka Mbeki, Nobel laureate Desmond Tutu, Mandla Mandela, Nelson Mandela's grandson, and many other notable South Africans who fought apartheid. In South Africa, Bantustans, as horrendous as they were sustained with government resources to maintain a pool of cheap labor. Within these enclaves, Black South Africans could move freely amongst themselves. They could breathe a little. And rarely did either the police or the military go into their communities. On the other hand, Israel has been actively working to get rid of Palestinians, slowly replacing us with imported Jews from around the world. There is nowhere for Palestinians to be in Palestine where their bodies, spirits, and dignity are not molested in some way by Israeli soldiers or paramilitary settlers. The home demolitions, the daily theft of land, of water, and property, the uprooting, burning, and cutting of fruit-bearing trees, the night raids, the systematic terrorizing of children, a matter of military policy to ensure Palestinians grow up fearing Israelis. The raiding, tear gassing, closing, restricting, and bombing of schools to ignorize our children through trauma. Not even in their most depraved hour did white South Africans bomb black South Africans with heavy war death machines, planes, helicopters, and tanks. Not in their most depraved hour did they calculate the calories allowed into Bantustans to keep millions of human beings on the edge of starvation. Not in their most depraved hour did they bomb and destroy water infrastructure, places of worship, sewage treatment plants, electrical grids, schools, playgrounds, or hospitals in order to break and destroy whole populations. We use the analogy of apartheid because it fits and it has a historic resonance. It is understood and appropriately repudiated. But Israel is worse, both qualitatively, as I've just said, and quantitatively, as Israeli apartheid has endured 30 years and counting longer than apartheid South Africa. I appreciate that B'Tselem, Israel's largest human rights organization, finally applied the word apartheid to their society. But I'd like to point out that this is not something that just crept up on them. It is not the result of increasingly right-wing governments. It is not because of Netanyahu or Trump. It is simply the condition of Israeli rule since they first conquered Palestine, expelling 80% of the indigenous population, putting those remaining under military rule for 18 years while they stole everything they could get their hands on, and instituting a legal system that designed to keep those Palestinians as inferiors. Palestinians have always spoken of this injustice. We've always decried it since Zionism first arrived on our shores with guns. I'm glad our Israeli counterparts have caught up. They are 7 decades late, but they've arrived and we're glad for it. Years ago, I gave a keynote talk at the first North American BDS conference, which was held at the University of Penn. For that talk, I researched some of Israel's laws and military orders that have been used to oppress and break Palestinians. And I'm going to begin my closing by reading a few of these laws. The first part are laws within Israel that apply to Israeli or Palestinian citizens of Israel. Section 5 in the Law of Political Parties and Section 7A of the Basic Law stipulates that any party platform that calls for full and complete equality between Jews and non-Jews can be disqualified from any political post. The law demands that Palestinian citizens may not challenge the state's Zionist identity. The law of return states that every Jew has the right to become a citizen no matter where they come from, while the indigenous non-Jewish inhabitants who were expelled in 1948 and 67 are expressly barred from returning to their homes. The Nakba law penalizes any institution that commemorates or publicly mourns the expulsion of the native Palestinian population. The anti-boycott law provides that anyone calling for the boycott of Israel or its illegal settlements can be sued by the boycott's targets without having to prove that they sustained damage, and then the court will decide how much compensation is to be paid. The admission committee's law formally allows neighborhood screening committees to prevent non-Jewish citizens from living in Jewish communities that control over 81% of the territory in Israel. The nation-state law states that the right to exercise self-determination is unique to the Jewish people, relegating indigenous Palestinian Christians and Muslims as subjects. This law establishes Hebrew as the official language, downgrading Arabic, the language spoken by the indigenous population for centuries in the land. The law also establishes Jewish settlements as a national value, mandating state resources for the expansion of illegal Jewish-only colonies built on confiscated Palestinian land. The amendment to the citizenship law stipulates that an Israeli citizen who marries a Palestinian cannot live as a couple in Israel with his or her spouse. A Palestinian spouse can neither gain citizenship nor residency. 93% of the land, the vast majority of which was confiscated from Palestinian owners after 1948, can only be owned by Jewish agencies for the benefit of Jews only. One of these agencies is the Jewish National Fund, which in its charter forbids the sale or lease to non-Jews. The specified goods tax and luxury tax law, Article 26, authorizes lower import taxes for Jewish citizens of Israel compared to non-Jewish citizens of Israel. The National Planning and Building Laws of 65, through various zoning laws, freezes the growth of existing Palestinian villages while providing for the expansion of Jewish settlements and the creation of new ones. The law also reclassifies a large portion of established ancient Palestinian villages as, quote, unrecognized and therefore non-existent, which allows the state to cut off water and electricity, as well as to simply appropriate the property. Appropriations are carried out under the requisitions law, which allows a competent authority to requisition the land called a requisition order, so that only he may, quote, use and exploit the land as he sees fit. This applies to home requisition orders as well, whereby another, quote, competent authority who can order the occupier, this is a quote, the order the occupier of a house to surrender the house to the control of a person specified in the order for residential purposes or for any other use as may be prescribed in the order, unquote. In the education sector within Israel, as an example, the state spends $192 per year per non-Jewish student compared to $1,100 per Jewish student. A mosque law has been debated off and on to prohibit the broadcasting of the Muslim call to prayer, which has been sounding over that land since the dawn of Islam. Also, for the first time in the history of Islam and the history of Christianity, Palestinian Muslims and Christians in the West Bank and Gaza are consistently denied access to their holy places of Jerusalem, even on the high holy days of Eid, Christmas, and Easter Sunday. In fact, since Israel took the West Bank, the Christian population has declined from 20,000 in 1967 to less than 7,500 today. Palestinians who live in the West Bank are subject to military orders, which are arbitrarily issued by a military commander and which immediately become law. Here are some examples of these military orders, of which there are literally thousands. Military Order 1229 authorizes Israel to hold Palestinians in administrative detention for up to 6 months without charge or trial. 6 month detentions can be renewed indefinitely without charge or trial. Military Order 329 and 1650 effectively prevents Palestinians from being anywhere in the West Bank without a specific permit to be there, making it a criminal offense to go from one Palestinian town to another. Military Order 92 and 158 gives the Israeli military control of all water resources in the West Bank, which belong to Palestinians in the first place. Israel then allows the Palestinian access to only a fraction of the shared water resources, while unlawful Israeli settlements receive virtually unlimited supplies, creating a reality of green lawns and swimming pools for Jewish settlers and a parched life for Palestinians, whose access to water, according to the WHO, does not meet the minimum requirements for basic human needs. Furthermore, that fraction of confiscated Palestinian water is sold to Palestinians at 300% more than what it costs Jewish settlers in the same area. Military Orders 811 and 847 allows Jews to purchase land from unwilling Palestinian sellers by using the, quote, power of attorney. Military Order 25 forbids public inspection of land transactions. Military 120, Order 128 gives the Israeli military the right to take over any Palestinian business which is not open during regular business hours. Military Order 138 and 134 forbids Palestinians from operating tractors or other heavy farm machinery on their land. Military Order 93 gives all Palestinian insurance businesses to the Israeli Insurance Syndicate. And Military Order 1015 requires Palestinians to get military permission to plant and grow fruit trees. This permit expires every year. Again, this is just a sampling of Israel's legal infrastructure, which is multi-tiered to apply to individuals based on their religion and place of residence. Today, we'll hear from experts who will expand our understanding of Israeli apartheid to explain why and how it has endured and avoided scrutiny while apartheid in South Africa was brought to its knees. I would like to urge everyone listening to become involved in putting an end to this monumental injustice. Israel's 74-year assault on Palestinians is an affront to humanity. It continues in part because the United States funds it. I'd like to point out that Betty McCollum has reintroduced a bill to condition aid to Israel on Israeli adherence to human rights standards, in particular, that no U.S. tax dollars be used to imprison and torture Palestinian children. This is a minimal recognition of Palestinian humanity, though it is sadly the only such bill to be introduced. I urge everyone listening to call and write your representatives to co-sponsor and support this bill, because it lays the groundwork upon which all of us can build a little compassion and justice into U.S. political system when it comes to Palestine. And beyond that, I encourage all of you to support Palestinian endeavors. Read our books, watch our films, engage in our institutions, buy our products, and lobby your lawmakers. For our part, Palestinians will never walk away from this struggle. Never. In the words of Zeev Jabotinsky, one of the early Zionist forefathers, he said, "They, Palestinians, look upon Palestine with the same instinctive love and true favor the Aztecs looked upon Mexico or any Sioux looked upon his prairie. Palestine will remain for the Palestinians not a borderland, but their birthplace, the center and basis of their own national existence." Thank you.
Thank you so much, Susan.
I have the honor of introducing Professor Walter L. Hickson, the author of numerous foreign policy books, who taught history for almost 40 years, achieving the rank of distinguished professor at the University of Akron. In 2019, he introduced his book, Israel's Armor, The Israel Lobby and the First Generation of the Palestine Conflict, in that year's National Press Club Conference. We were so impressed by his expertise on the Israel lobby and its impact on U.S. democracy that we asked him to become a contributing editor and pen a regular column he calls History's Shadows. That column and his book reviews are now favorites in each issue of the Washington Report. Professor Hickson, his talk is called The Israel Lobby, What Everyone Needs to Know. He will talk about his latest book, which is on sale right now. You can see it, the book cover flashing by. It's called Architects of Repression, How Israel and Its Lobby Put Racism, Violence, and Injustice at the Center of U.S. Middle Eastern Policy. His book describes the most powerful lobby acting on behalf of a foreign government in all of American history. Most historians and professors steer clear of this taboo subject, but Professor Hickson dives right in to describe the role the Israel lobby plays to enable aggression, the suppression of Palestinian rights, and the failure to achieve a comprehensive Middle East peace. Take it away, Walter.
Well, thank you, Delinda, and thank you to Grant Smith and Dale Prusansky and Janet McMahon and Julia Pittner, and for all the work you've done putting together this conference. It's been a lot of effort and you all have done a great job. So here's 25 minutes, The Israel Lobby, What Everyone Needs to Know. The Israel Lobby is the most powerful and the most pernicious lobby representing the interests of a foreign nation in all of American history. the little state of Israel, not the behemoths Russia or China, as many Americans might imagine or have been led to believe, intrudes more directly into American domestic politics than any other nation in the world. Through these intrusions, the Israel lobby has secured massive American funding for Israel, even though it is an apartheid settler colonial state, a regional aggressor, and a major violator of human rights norms. In addition, Israel and its lobby have been primarily responsible for the failure to achieve a comprehensive Middle East peace. Finally, Israel and the lobby have long propelled, in conjunction, to be sure, with U.S. support for reactionary but oil-rich Arab regimes, a disastrous American foreign policy in the Middle East, replete with political instability and forever wars. While the self-serving purpose of lobbies is apparent, the Israel lobby itself is sprawling and complex. It is not a single monolithic entity, but rather a multifaceted grouping of ideas, individuals, and organizations united by the commitment to dispense pro-Israel propaganda and simultaneously to discredit critical analysis of the Zionist state. The largest and most well-funded Israel lobby organization, of course, is AIPAC. It's not only far and away the most powerful foreign policy lobby in Washington, it is one of the most powerful lobbies, period. A colossus in the world of Washington politics, AIPAC is often mentioned in the same breath as the gun, pharmaceutical, and retired persons lobbies. As M.J. Rosenberg, a man who should know, having worked as an AIPAC propagandist himself for many years in the past, explains, AIPAC uses the resources of wealthy people in the American Jewish community to enforce a kind of political orthodoxy in Congress, on the White House, and on the media. Its purpose is to make sure no one in a position of power deviates from the Israel line. AIPAC has long worked closely with the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Both groups typically act in lockstep with the Israeli government. The lobby also encompasses wealthy individual donors, political action committees, and myriad other Jewish and Christian Zionist organizations, federations, pressure groups, media watchdogs, college campus organizations, and think tanks. There are literally hundreds of such entities in existence, including city, regional, and statewide organizations throughout the country and in Europe as well. All right, in order to fully appreciate the role of the lobby, to understand why it is so large, so powerful, and so crucial to Israel, it is necessary to understand Israel's identity as a settler colonial state. So bear with me for a little history. More than a trendy term, settler colonialism illuminates the essential mission of settler states, which is to displace or otherwise eliminate the indigenous population. No one framed the issue more succinctly than the Israeli patriarch David Ben-Gurion, who in 1937 declared in a letter to his son, "We must expel Arabs and take their place." Thus, from the outset, more than a decade before the creation of Israel, the leaders of the Zionist settler colonial movement sought to gain control of as much land as possible with as few indigenous Palestinians as possible remaining on that land. From the Nakba to the efforts to drive Palestinians out of East Jerusalem this very day, Israel has manifested this fundamental core identity. In my view, Israel is thus best understood as a congenitally aggressive settler state. While Israel had much in common with other settler societies throughout history, in certain crucial respects, Zionist settlement was and remains unique. The demonization of Jews, which endured for centuries and reached its apogee in the Nazi genocide, was, of course, a distinctive and driving force behind the Zionist movement. Scarred by the traumas of historic anti-Semitism, Zionist leaders such as Ben-Gurion, Menachem Begin, and many others vowed never again to be the victims. Instead, they became the relentless and unapologetic aggressors in Palestine. The other distinguishing feature, and this is the one that is really crucial to fully appreciate why the Israel lobby is the colossus that it is today, pertains to timing. The Zionist settler state arrived on the international scene much later than the earlier settler societies. Unlike colonial North America, Australia, and other settler societies of previous centuries, Israel and the American lobby encountered serious global challenges to settler colonial aggression. World War II and the Nazi genocide had highlighted the horrors of ethnic discrimination and mass killing, spurring the creation of the UN, recognition of the rights of indigenous peoples, and the Declaration of Universal Human Rights. The late arrival of Jewish settler colonialism in Palestine established Israel as a reactionary as well as a congenitally aggressive settler colonial state. The violent removal policies aimed at settling as many Jews with as few Palestinians as possible remaining on the land came in sharp contradiction to the post-war vision of decolonization, international justice, and racial equality. Israel thus required powerful international support backed by determined campaigns of disinformation to counter the efforts to call the Zionist state to account for its aggression in Palestine. The United States, the most powerful country in the world, the nation with the largest Jewish population in the world, the heartland of Christian Zionism, and an apartheid nation itself at the time, was the obvious and indispensable ally whose support or absence thereof could make or break the Zionist movement. As Israel carried out its identity as a reactionary settler state, the U.S. State Department, other countries of the world, and the UN attempted to rein in Zionist aggression, which included ethnic cleansing, disdain for the plight of Palestinian refugees, borderland expansion, and laying claim to Jerusalem as the exclusive capital. A massive and perpetual propaganda effort thus arose for the express purpose of countering international pressure in the wake of the 1947 partition of Palestine. Over time, the lobby dramatically expanded in scope and sophistication in concert with the unfolding of Israel's continuous settler colonial aggression. In addition to the assault on Egypt in the 1956 Suez or Sinai War, myriad attacks targeted Jordan and Syria in the years leading up to the June 1967 war, an expansive war that Israel wanted and could not be dissuaded from launching. Under the influence of the increasingly powerful Israel lobby, the United States provided military assistance, including sophisticated jet aircraft, even as Israel illegally occupied and began to settle the territories seized in the Six-Day War, even as it introduced nuclear weapons into the Middle East, thus thumbing its nose at the 1968 Non-Proliferation Treaty, even as it brutally repressed the Palestinian Intifada in the 1980s and 1990s, even as it refused to make peace even as it repeatedly attacked Lebanon and the Gaza Strip, killing and injuring tens of thousands of innocent people, and even as it refused to make peace. Israel's American-backed aggression fueled the rise of Islamic militancy, heightened regional political instability, and though it is often denied, played a prominent role in provoking the September 11th blowback attacks and the subsequent global war on terror. Today, Israeli aggression continues through blatant violations of international law in the construction of Jewish-only settlements totaling some 700,000 people in the illegally occupied Palestinian territories, as well as in military assaults on Iran and Syria, and assassinations that have become routine. None of this long history of regional aggression would have been possible without American support and largesse secured by the machinations of the metastasizing Israel lobby. In order to secure funding and political support, the lobby obscured Israel's fundamental identity as a congenitally aggressive settler state running roughshod over indigenous Palestinians. The lobby instead depicted Israel as a beleaguered innocent surrounded by fanatical Arabs who sought to drive the Zionist state into the sea. This disinformation campaign obscured Israel's history of aggression, as well as its military supremacy, which had been clearly manifested in the June 1967 war and became even more pronounced thereafter. Far from the peace-loving sole democracy of the Middle East, as lobby propaganda would have it, Israel has been the clear aggressor in the so-called Palestine conflict. Just as we do not blame indigenous North Americans for the centuries of so-called Indian wars, it is wrong to blame the native residents of Palestine for the Middle East conflict. They have been the victims, not the aggressors. Lobby propaganda went on to promote Israel as a Cold War ally and national security asset of the United States, paving the way for the continuous flow of massive U.S. military assistance, which has far exceeded that provided to any other nation. As collaboration grew, the United States itself began to mirror the practices of the smaller security state as it instituted increasingly militarized methods of policing at home, as well as targeted assassination abroad. In the face of mounting criticism in recent decades, the Israel lobby has become increasingly aggressive, resorting to disinformation, lawfare, character assassination, attacks on freedom of speech, and cynical efforts to equate criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. Not content to repress Palestinians, the lobby now seeks to deprive their fellow Americans of the fundamental liberty of freedom of speech. Over the years, AIPAC and its allies have taken command of public discourse and undermined presidential authority. But the lobby has been most pronounced in its domination of the Congress of the United States. With rare and anomalous exceptions, Israel gets what it wants from the Congress, including, of course, money. Beginning with the Truman administration, when the nascent lobby tapped the Congress for funding for the settlement of Jewish refugees, even as the Zionist state drove some 750,000 Palestinians from their homes, Israel has taken hold of the congressional purse strings from that time forward. Over the ensuing years, the increasingly powerful lobby ensured that Israel received annual allocations that eventually came to be provided through an early distribution process that was made available to Israel alone of all the nations in the world. According to the Congressional Research Service, since 1948, Israel, a small nation of less than 9 million people, has been the most heavily subsidized foreign country in American history. Since the creation of Israel in 1948, the CRS notes, the United States has provided Israel 146 billion current or non-inflation adjusted dollars in bilateral assistance and missile defense funding. These massive allocations have enabled Israel to become one of the most powerful military regimes in the world. Today, the money continues to flow despite Israel's ongoing aggression and blatant violations of international law through the construction of the Jewish-only settlements and attacks and assassinations that it carries on with impunity. Israel currently enjoys the fruits of a 10-year, $38 billion package, even though it already has, far and away, the preeminent military power in the region and does not face any legitimate threats to its security. Like a trained circus animal, the United States thus routinely doles out billion-dollar annual welfare checks to a foreign country located some 7,000 miles from American shores, a country that has no compelling need for the assistance. Those annual billions of dollars could, of course, be devoted instead to critically important domestic needs or be allocated to more deserving countries, including, for example, impoverished Central American neighbors whose desperate refugees appear on American doorsteps. So how can we explain an utterly irrational policy in which the United States routinely doles out billions of dollars to a small, developed, and militarized nation, one that openly represses 20% of its own population while illegally colonizing adjacent territory, terrorizing its neighbors in the process? What explains the unstinting support for apartheid Israel? Cultural affinity for Israel, including the religious motivations of Christian Zionism, plays an underlying role, to be sure. But the main reason for the American largesse is because Israel and its lobby have a vice grip on the U.S. Congress. In Architects of Repression, I offer a detailed history of the tactics the lobby deploys to receive congressional funding, including providing or withholding campaign funds, letter writing campaigns for and against legislation, orchestrated public demonstrations, junkets to Israel, and other effective lobbying techniques. Make no mistake, and of course, Brian Baird can weigh in on this, members of Congress live in mortal fear of AIPAC. They are always made fully aware of AIPAC's positions on any given matter relating to Israel, and they are well-trained to toe the pro-Israel line. Otherwise, they know they will pay the political consequences. This deplorable situation is about more than money. Fundamentally, it is about the perversion of democracy and the abject failure of a preeminent American public institution, the People's House, the United States Congress. With the exception of the Squad, Representative Betty McCollum, Senator Bernie Sanders, and a few others, the members of Congress, conservatives and liberals alike, learn to obey the golden rule, which is this: Israel gets what it wants, no questions asked, virtually no criticism allowed. For decades, Israel and its lobby have been stunningly successful, not only in generating lopsided support for Israel, but also in deterring analysis of their role in manipulating the American political process. Israel has been enabled through the persistent disinformation campaigns, the chokehold on Congress, and the timidity of the majority of American journalists, academics, and publishers. Whenever an effort is made to critically analyze Israeli aggression, the lobby strikes back with disinformation and ad hominem attack, as the distinguished scholars John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt discovered some 15 years ago. Despite their formidable power and the long run of remarkable success, the tide of history is, however, turning against Israel and its lobby. At the beginning of the 21st century, Palestinians launched the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, BDS movement, to mobilize worldwide economic and moral pressure against Israel's annexationist and apartheid policies. Despite a fierce reaction from Israel and the lobby, replete with intimidation and lawfare, the grassroots movement, fueled by the global public awareness and the demand for human rights and international justice, is not backing down. In 2018, Israel became its own worst enemy by proclaiming itself an exclusively Jewish state, with Hebrew as the official language. Ensconced in the Constitution, the nation-state law legally marginalizes 20% of Israel's population, comprised of Palestinians, Christian as well as Muslim, and makes a mockery of the longtime Zionist propaganda claim that Israel is the sole democracy of the Middle East. In addition, by repeatedly re-electing Benjamin Netanyahu, among other palpably racist politicians, annexing Jerusalem and the Golan Heights, and by moving toward annexation of the West Bank, Israel has become, as we've just discussed, a de facto apartheid state. Israel's reactionary congenital aggression is complicating the lobby's work. Although nearly all Republicans, as well as mainstream or centrist Democrats led by President Joe Biden and Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, maintain virtually unquestioned loyalty to Israel and the lobby, the handful of progressive elected representatives advocating justice in Palestine are holding onto their seats despite AIPAC's venomous attacks and targeting of them. In 2020, AIPAC also suffered some key defeats in congressional elections, as its candidates far outspent their opponents but lost anyway. A 2019 Center for American Progress poll found that 71% of Democrats and more than half of Americans as a whole favored conditioning U.S. aid to Israel if it continued to construct illegal settlements and followed through with plans to annex portions of the West Bank. The split between the Democratic Party elites and their base is fast reaching unsustainable proportions. In addition to confronting a loosening of their vice grip on Congress, Israel and the lobby are increasingly alienating a core constituency, American Jews. Traditionally politically progressive, more and more American Jews are acknowledging that Israel's rejectionism has precluded a just peace. Many Jews worldwide are acknowledging the crisis of Zionism as well as the failure of the sham peace process. Israel and the lobby thus face a future of growing grassroots Jewish opposition, combined with the eventual passing of aging Jewish megadonors, personified by the recent death of the 87-year-old casino mogul Sheldon Adelson. Continuing struggle over Palestine lies ahead and may well pivot on what happens in the United States rather than the Middle East itself. AIPAC fully understands the threats that it faces, has been mobilizing its resources to fight them, and is accustomed to winning. Since 2008, AIPAC has dramatically expanded its funding, physical facilities in Washington, and more than doubled its number of employees. Prior to the cancellation of its 2021 Washington conference owing to the pandemic, the AIPAC annual meeting was attracting more than 18,000 people, including a majority of the members of Congress sitting alongside the members of the Israeli Knesset. In addition, the Israel lobby, as Grant Smith has revealed, is also expanding dramatically into state governments. Despite the clear and pernicious influence of the Israel lobby that I have outlined today and explain in depth in my book, skeptics, including sadly some well-known advocates for justice in Palestine, inexplicably insist on downplaying the influence of the lobby. While few people question the clout of the gun, pharmaceutical, and elderly person lobbies, applying the same logic to Israel is to the Israel lobby is nonetheless too often derided as hyperbole, if not a conspiracy theory. Deniers cite the rare and ephemeral defeats suffered by Israel in the lobby, ignoring that they have prevailed for decades on far and away the most significant issue, precluding a comprehensive Middle East peace accord while enabling the relentless expansion of Jewish-only settlements and Israel's violent aggression in the region. Allow me to channel Robert McNamara on Vietnam in response to all those who would deny lobby influence. You are wrong. You are terribly wrong. By clinging to the pretension that a focus on the lobby is for smaller minds and conspiracy theorists, you are part of the problem rather than of the solution. You are making the lobby's job easier and the task of promoting justice in Palestine more difficult. Please, if you do not care to study the lobby and inform yourself as to the depth and significance of its activities, the best move you can make is to hit your mute button on this subject. The stakes are high in the struggle for justice in Palestine and for understanding the power of Israel and the lobby within the United States. In addition to the financial costs to the American taxpayer, there are political, moral, and national security costs and consequences as well. The United States has undermined its oft-proclaimed commitment to liberty and democracy through its support of Zionist repression in Palestine and through its obeisance to a lobby serving the interests of a foreign power. The United States has also badly compromised the United Nations as a forum for peacemaking and promotion of international justice. It remains possible to create a unified state or some form of negotiated political entity in which Jews, Muslims, Christians, and others would be free to live, work, and worship in a shared space, with Jerusalem and its special places open and accessible to all. Israel is located in the Middle East. Many of its citizens are Sephardic Jews who migrated from other Middle East countries, and Israel therefore has the potential to become a decolonized Middle Eastern nation. The dramatic changes that are required in the Middle East and Middle East politics depend to a great extent on a critical mass of Americans coming to understand that they are financing racial repression, aggression, and attacks on free speech. At a minimum, the United States should make all future financial assistance and political support of Israel dependent upon a just solution in Palestine. In order to make this approach a reality, the lobby's grip on Congress must be publicized, condemned, and broken. The liberation of Palestine and of Americans from an oppressive lobby is on the agenda of humanity. Thank you.
You have been listening to Palestinian author and activist Susan Abulawa and Professor Emeritus Walter Hickson speaking at the recent conference sponsored by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. And that wraps it up for today. Thank you for joining us this morning on This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. Please tune in again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, hoping that you will get involved in the struggle to bring justice to the Palestinian people. We will talk again next week.